this, so if he comes back with the same crew, and if we get Jeff, so Jeff, apparently Jeff Bush, is that just you? Did you fill out one of the forms yet?
Yeah.
Okay, so that should
be. Yeah, I did. And I actually Palestine too. Yeah.
Or is it Joe? That's all it takes to drive down the class is one complainer.
And I never smile.
Okay, so I think we're gonna be good until Stan comes. Did I give you?
No, I only have the Talistide sheet.
Okay.
Okay.
And I think everything's pretty self-explanatory in there.
Yeah.
The grading thing, I'm not even sure what the... I just used the grading from our school. But if you do everything and you do a good job, good quality work, you'll probably get an A. If you haven't turned in everything yet from the former class, get as much turned in as possible, and then the more you turn in, the better the grade's going to be.
You get extra points for turning in on time.
Yeah, you're pretty much. If I grade on a curve, I mean you're the standard. So I think everything's pretty self-explanatory. Last week, all we did was talked about, we defined what a worldview is.
Yeah. I do have one question before we start.
Sure.
What is an approved worldview topic?
Where'd you see
that? What is that?
Under your course requirements, last month the student will have to type an 8-10-page paper, double space, 12 font, Chicago South.
Oh, approved. Approved. It just means I gotta approve it so that, you know, if you end up handing in a paper and you worked real hard, it's like how subsidies have destroyed the farm, you know, agriculture in America. It's like, no, that's not a worldview topic. So just make sure you run it by me. Okay. But if it's any of the major worldviews or a collection of the major worldviews, you know it's going to be fine. And you can even get to a specific religion, because each religion is based on its own worldview. So if you don't put that in, you will get, like, if you have bigger classes, and you will get somebody who will, you know, well, I was going to say write a paper on aliens or something, but technically you could do a Christian worldview critique of the UFO movement. I mean, that's certainly within the bounds. In fact, that'd be more relevant than most of the apologetics we do today. But just remember that the primary textbook is going to be James Sire, The Universe Next Door, preferably the fifth edition, because he adds Islam and postmodernism. And we're going to be referring to this a lot. Really try to read through it. The guy's got a PhD, I think, in literature or something, but the whole English departments they were the first to get saturated with postmodern thought, so automatically you've got to be on your toes philosophically. But he's not an easy read if you're not used to reading philosophical stuff. But I'll be breaking down a lot of the things that he talks about in here. So we defined the worldview, and then we looked at several different worldviews. And I'm trying to think where would be a good place to find a list of those for those who weren't here last week.
Twice.
know I've got a list somewhere in these books on the different worldviews. And but it might be in the one that you don't have, or in the world religions one too, so. But whatever the case is, atheism, no God. Agnosticism, man cannot know God or no knowledge of God. Deism, a God who created the world but doesn't intervene, doesn't perform miracles. Pantheism, God is the universe. Panentheism, God is in the universe, or the universe is God's body. Dualism, two competing gods. Polytheism, many gods. So I'll make sure I get a list to you if you need them before the. And then which one is that? Which
it's in the world religions.
Yeah, see, and that's not everybody has it with them. Yeah, so it's in the world religions one. That's on page what?
Six, row six.
Page six. So. So if you can dig up your old world religions, there might be a couple still over there. I'm not sure.
Oh yeah, behind the old.
In fact, I should get the markers anyway.
That's a different worldviews.
I think I've arrived because they're not there. So. I mean, somebody stole them the first time. Well. People have stolen my books before, but they usually return them. So the different worldviews. Now we're going to look at how James Sire tests the worldviews. So if you do have that textbook, he's got seven basic questions, and that's really interesting. Now, he's not a mathematician. He's a... an English major, so we can forgive him for this, but he says seven basic questions, and there's actually eight of them. So he added an eighth one to it, and it's on page 22 of the fifth edition one. I'm not sure.
No, it's in here.
You'll have at least seven of the eight there. So, but a worldview is a way that we view reality, and there's different ways to view reality. And so the seven basic worldview questions, I'm going to be putting these, and again, debatable. I'm going to be putting these in my own words to kind of simplify them. But first is, what is prime reality, the really real? And the way I would word that, what is ultimate reality? Okay. Like for Plato, in his thought, it was the world of ideas. I don't know if a lot of people know this or not, but Plato believed the physical world of particular things, they are less than fully real. That's not a Christian position. The Christian position, God, and the Jewish position, God created a real physical world. But in Plato's thought, this chair is not fully real, because you could take it apart and turn it into a table, okay? But the real chair is an eternal, unchanging chair, and if it's physical, it would be changing. You could change it, and it could eventually rot. So the real chair is the eternal, unchanging idea of chairness that all particular chairs share in. And so Plato's thought was not very Christian on that particular topic there. And so for him, the ultimately real is the world of unchanging ideas. Now, St. Augustine was a Christian philosopher who embraced a lot of Plato's thought, kind of a form of Middle Platonism or Neoplatonism. And so St. Augustine said, yeah, but Plato, ideas just hanging there don't make sense. Ideas exist in a mind. So the eternal, unchanging ideas must exist in a mind, and by definition, that mind would have to be an eternal, unchanging mind. And so, basically, Augustine took Plato's theory of the forms or the ideas and turned it into an argument for God's existence. Now, since Augustine was Christian, the physical realm had to be real, but that doesn't mean that the physical realm is the ultimately real. For Augustine, since he's a Christian, the ultimately real is the triune God of the Bible, and the triune God is the ultimate reality that always was and always will be, and then that ultimate reality had the ability to create out of nothing the universe that exists, not just the physical universe, but even spirit entities like angels. So Jesus is, Colossians 1:15-17, Jesus is the creator not just of the visible realm, but the invisible realm as well. So what is ultimate reality? The atheists are going to answer that in a totally different way. Don't let anybody fool you into thinking that atheism is a newer view, and then they hit you with some chronological snobbery and say the newer is better. It's because we're so advanced now, and that's why these guys became atheists. No, there were atheists several hundred years among the Greek philosophers, Thales and the Milesian school, before Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. And they laughed at the atheists and said, they're reductionists, they're reducing everything to material. So ultimate reality is an eternal changing physical world. And they said, no, that doesn't explain values and beauty and truth and morality. And Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle would say only an idiot would deny the existence of those things. So they acknowledged a non-physical realm of reality beyond the physical realm. But atheists are going to say the ultimate reality is the physical universe, and that really shows the anti-intellectualism. Now, they usually act so arrogant, and they're so snobbish about it, and then they've got so much money, and they're heading philosophy departments and science departments, so they try to pretend to be real smart, but at least Friedrich Nietzsche, who died in 1900, had somewhat of an excuse for saying, I don't believe in God, because he believed that the ultimate reality was the physical universe. It always was there, always will be, it's eternal. Well, since the 1920s, it's been scientifically, almost unanimously embraced that the universe had a beginning because of the expansion of the universe and Big Bang cosmology. So now it's, okay, well, I'm an atheist. I don't think the universe needs a cause, even though it had a beginning. Well, that's stupid. If something had a beginning, it had to have a cause. I mean, nothing can't produce something. Non-being cannot cause being. So the atheist is going to say the ultimate reality is the physical world, but now they've got to also address the problem that the physical world wasn't always there. So it's a very, very weak, I would call it an anti-intellectual stance to hold. But, so what is ultimate reality? That's the question we've got to ask. By the way, it would be nice if Sire were capable of answering all these 8 worldview questions in the same order. But unfortunately, even for a brilliant guy like him, it's not always possible, since some worldviews, you know, point number 2 might flow right into point number 7. So don't worry about them. Just worry about what the 8 questions are. Don't worry about what order they're in, because rarely does he even address all 8 in this order. So what is the ultimately real thing? What is ultimate reality? Number 2, what is the nature of external reality? That is the world around us, okay? And so that would be what is the material? material world. Now, Sire would probably have a heart attack hearing me ask it like that, but for us Westerners, that's a good way to ask it. And then the answer to that question might be, well, I don't believe in a material world. So then the Hindu might say, that's Maya, the physical world is less than fully real. Plato would say, yeah, it's not these particular things are not real at all, but they're not fully real. They're only real so long as they participate in the eternal, unchanging idea as real. But if we just word the question like that, what is the material world? Is there a physical world that exists outside of our minds? Can we know it? You know, things of that sort. Question number three, what is a human being? And, you know, the atheists would tell us, well, we got a good answer to that. Well, okay, well, good, because now you kicked God out of America, kicked prayer to the public schools in 1963, and we started killing babies before they're born in 1973. So I guess human beings aren't as valuable as they used to be. And now we don't even know if we're boys or girls. We don't know what bathrooms to use. We perform weddings for two guys or for two gals. So, but the fact of the matter, the atheist is arguing that human beings are mere molecules in motion. Okay? So if you came here today and you saw me kicking a mound of dirt, it wouldn't be any, you might think, well, that's weird, but, you know, most professors are weird. But if you saw me kicking a little kid, okay? You're either going to take me down or call the police or, you know, you're going to react much differently. But if atheism is true, there's really no difference between the two. A mound of dirt is just mere molecules in motion, and so is a human being. And so you want to get upset with Adolf Hitler for putting innocent human beings into ovens? You better come up with some good reason why human life is valuable. And the answer is all men are created equal. Founding fathers knew that, and they got it from the Bible, that God created man, male and female, in his image. And so what is a human being? We would say human beings were created in God's image, but now we're fallen. But we're redeemable, okay? So each worldview has to address these types of things. Okay, what happens to a person at death? Number four, so you can say, is there... life after death? Is there life after death? Most atheists would say no. Some pantheists would usually say yes, but it's not really conscious. Life, once you escape a cycle of reincarnation, things of that sort. Then number five, why is it possible to know anything at all? I'll just say is, some are going to say it's not, which is a claim to know something. Is it possible to know something? If you answer yes, then why? You know, why or why not? So this is what philosophers call epistemology, theory of knowledge. Is it possible to know something? How do we know what is right and what is wrong? So number six would be, it's almost as bad as my mark at school. Is there such things as right? It's real easy to say, no such thing as right and wrong. Each person or each culture decides. But then we all, if you're human, you make moral value judgments. You know? Even when things are going rotten, if you're an atheist, you scream out, why me? You're saying, well, how come me? This is not fair. You're making a moral value judgment. Okay? You're acting like there's this thing called justice and it's real. And so is there such things as right, or are there, it should be, are there such things as right and wrong? And number 7, what is the meaning of human history? So, I'll word it this way. Does history make sense? Does it have a purpose? Is it going somewhere? You know, reincarnation, they usually say it's cyclical because you just keep coming back at something, but eventually the goal is to escape reincarnation. So there's actually a linear aspect, like, well, it's kind of like, okay, linear would be like this, like history's going somewhere. Like the new heavens and new earth, or the kingdom of God coming to earth, okay? We usually call Hinduism, because it's believed in reincarnation, cyclical. But it really isn't just a circle, because the goal...
Slinky.
Yeah, the goal eventually is to escape the cycle of reincarnation where your soul becomes one with the world soul. Now, the only time I've read, and maybe I'm wrong, that anybody that their worldview is just totally cyclical is Friedrich Nietzsche, the German atheist. He had a view called eternal recurrence, where he said he believed that the universe is finite, that it doesn't go on and on forever. And he believed that the universe is eternal, so we have an infinite amount of time. And he believed all we are is mere molecules in motion. So he believed that all that's going on with history is a reshuffling of molecules or atoms. Okay? So he said, well, wait a minute. If we have infinite amount of time and the molecules keep getting reshuffled, then, you know, hopefully you guys are going to enjoy this class, because if Friedrich Nietzsche is correct, you're going to be damned to repeat this class over and over and over again throughout all eternity. And that's his doctrine of eternal recurrence. And so it... finite space but infinite time, logic would demand that. Now, by the way, if that's not hell, I don't know what is. We've always done something where you did something once and you really like, especially when you're playing with a little kid. And you're playing with your kid or your grandkid, and they love it. And you did something, oh, he thought it was cute, he loved it. And then the fifth time, oh, he still loves it, he wants to do it again. And then maybe they learn the word more, and you just keep saying more and more, and you keep doing it, keep doing it. And about 25 times, you're like, look, kid, just get away from me. You're driving me nuts. I don't want to, you know, and you don't want to make the kid cry, but the kid's going to eventually make you cry. So, I mean, earthly pleasures over and over again, it can be, you know, it can be like hell on earth, no escape. So does history make sense? Is it linear? Does it have a purpose? Is there a plan behind it? And Christianity would say yes. In fact, the three theistic religions with a personal God would say yes. Christianity, Islam, and Judaism would say that we are moving towards the final judgment, when God will separate his true followers from the wicked. Okay? Now, obviously, there's a big difference between how one gets to be a true follower in Christianity versus Islam and the present state of Judaism. But the fact of the matter is, the theistic religion is because of a personal God who designed humans and designed the universe. He also had a design or a plan for human history as well. So does history make sense? And then he added number 8, what personal life-orienting core commitments are consistent with this worldview? And I would just say, like, kind of, what practical differences does your worldview make? This is where Nietzsche scolded his atheist buddies because they acted like God is dead and now it's business as usual, nothing changes. Well, wait a minute, if God is dead, everything changes. That's what Nietzsche told them. We Americans are really weird. Americans have never embraced philosophical atheism, the belief that there's no God. But we've embraced practical atheism. We live like there's no God. And we don't see that. Look, if we still believe in God, and most Americans say they do, then it's not okay if you're biologically a guy and you decide you want to pretend to be a gal. If there's a God, you're what he created you to be. And so it's pretty amazing that here in America, we can reject philosophical atheism, but embrace a practical atheism. But worldviews do make a difference. The Christian worldview, we can condemn the actions of Adolf Hitler. He said you should not kill innocent people. Judaism, their theistic worldview, they could say, yeah, you were killing us. You weren't supposed to kill innocent human beings. Now, I guess if you really stick to the Quran, which does promote violence against infidels, the Muslim worldview would entail, well, you didn't kill enough innocent people. Because there's, Nazis should have been killing themselves. They weren't Muslims. But whatever the case, a worldview does make a difference. One of the practical differences of the New Age worldview, the main goal is to bring about the New Age of enlightenment, spiritual enlightenment. And if we're going to do that, then you got to weed out those people who are holding back the earth from attaining to that. So if people are not open to the idea that man is God, if you have what Barbara Marx Hubbard would call the selfish idea that there is a God and you're not him, well, there's no room for you in this neo-pagan world order. So worldviews do have consequences. So Sayer does a good job pointing out those questions, and then he starts applying it to different worldviews. Now, we'll be looking at how he applies it to Christianity and deism and naturalism. But we're not going to cover that, go through that the entire way through the book. We'll take some shortcuts so that we could save some time when talking about probably postmodernism and neo-paganism and stuff. But just keep in mind how he, if you're going to highlight in your book, I'd highlight those worldview questions. And I would also highlight the answers to those worldview questions in each of the chapters on the different worldviews. That will give you a good understanding of it. You should read the book cover to cover, but in the if you want to review it, you should be able to read the worldview question and say the answer to it and say, yeah, I understand that answer, or I don't quite understand that one. Let me read a little bit further. Oh, yeah, now I remember what he was getting at here, okay? But whatever the case, so those are the worldview questions. So does anybody have any questions about that? Francis Schaeffer was real big in a Christian manifesto where he talked about the Christian church is so bad. This was back in the early 1980s, shortly before he died, that Christians are so bad at what we deal with. We'll deal with separate political, moral issues like they're all not connected. And we misunderstand there's the reason why we have abortion, the reason why we have infanticide and sometimes euthanasia, the reason why we have gay marriage now. It's all because of a shift in worldview. And we went from the Christian worldview, our leadership went to a deistic worldview, God who doesn't perform miracles, then to a naturalistic, secular humanist worldview, and now we're moving on to a postmodern worldview, soon to be a neo-pagan worldview, and things are going to get, if you think they're crazy now, they're going to get even a lot crazier as we move forward in time. But anybody have any questions or comments on that? And if not, then we'll move right into it.
Was Nietzsche? Was he? I've heard of people refer to him as an honest atheist because he recognized the dangers of removing God from the equation, and he.
Yeah, I think he was the most honest would be a good word in some areas. Maybe even though he didn't consider honesty a virtue, and he said truth is metaphor. So you know, when you have a metaphor, when you have symbolic language, there's a truth that's behind it. Well, he says behind every metaphor is another metaphor. There is no truth, which is a self-refuting statement. But whatever the case, I think he was what I would call him is the most consistent famous atheist who ever lived. At the same time, he recognized if God is dead, if there's no God, there's no truth, no morality, no meaning. But then he thought this would produce the Superman, who through their will to power, not through reason, but through their will to power, they're going to create, they're going to play God. This is what I call the deification of the state. But these supermen are going to play God. They're going to create their own truth. And it's going to be stuff that's advantageous to them since they don't believe in any real truth. They're going to create their own morality, their own laws, their own meaning. And that's going to produce the next stage in the spiritual evolution of mankind. Well, if he were a totally consistent atheist, he'd be a total nihilist. Where if there's no God, no truth, no meaning, no morality, no value to human life, there's really no man. If God is dead, man is dead too. And so a really truly consistent atheist would be a nihilist. Like we say, creation ex nihilo. It's nihilo, that's creation out of nothing. Well, nihilism realizes if God doesn't exist, nothing makes sense, and in the end, nothing really amounts to anything. And then you'll have philosophers trying to figure out, okay, well, why shouldn't we all commit suicide? You know, Paul said, if the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. So I think he was the most consistent atheist. His buddies wanted to throw God off the bridge, and Nietzsche was like, yeah, I'm totally with you on that. Let's get rid of this old, outdated Christian myth that holds back human creativity and human evolution. But you guys were wrong to go through his pockets before you threw him off the bridge. You said, oh, absolute morality, we need that. Absolute truth, oh, we gotta have that. Oh, meaning in life, oh, value to human life, yeah, we need all those things. Okay, now let's throw God off the bridge. And so they were saying, look, God is dead, let's party, and it's business as usual. C.S. Lewis, Francis, I'm going through my whole paper on that, the Western civilization. Friedrich Nietzsche said, look, God is dead, forget about partying, I'm terrified. Everything is up for grabs. We don't even have, We don't even have up and down anymore. We've detached the sun from its moon. If you look at your secular religions, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, though. But we will read it in this class. We have a section on nihilism after Marxist communism and secular humanism. And so I have a page on nihilism, and then right next to it is Nietzsche's The Madman Parable from his work, The Gay Science. And gay meant something different back then. It just meant happy. And but that's a really good summary of Nietzsche's thought. And if you notice, he's the madman who comes out too early with the lantern. You don't need a lantern in the morning, you need it at night. So he realizes, I came out too early, they think I'm mad because I'm crying out, God is dead. But the people that are around there laughing at him are also people who don't believe in God. And they're making fun of him. So his main complaints are not about the church. It's about fellow atheists. Now, I wish I could say he really liked the church. Well, he did. His little paragraph at the end, he walks into a church and he says, what good is these churches? They're nothing but sepulchers of a dead God. So basically, he was predicting that nobody's going to worship. Once the death of God is fully realized, he died in 1900, and by the mid-20th century, none of the great big churches in Europe, big cathedrals and all, there's really no worship, the exception of a few, no real worship going on. They're museums now, because of the architecture. And so might as well be tombs of a dead God. So, but that's a good summary of Nietzsche's thought. So we'll go over that in Nietzsche's own words and talk about that. So, okay, so let's look at the chapter on Christianity, Christian theism. Now, with theism, you got the three main theistic religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, okay? What Sire does, and I really like it, I read a lot of books, like Norman Geisler used to have a book, Worlds Apart, where each chapter is just a different chapter on a worldview. The thing was, it was kind of like a philosophical work, but it didn't trace the historical evolution of worldviews in the West. By him starting with the Christian worldview, he could have started, if he wanted to, with the ancient pagan worldview, and then show how Christianity, by about 380 to 400, A.D., was becoming the dominant worldview in Western civilization, and it held on to that position for a good, 1,300 years or so. And so I do like that he goes from, he starts with the Christian worldview, the dominant worldview in the history of Western civilization, and that eventually gave way to deism, due to Enlightenment, rationalism, modernistic thought, and that gave way to naturalism, what we often call atheism, and then eventually existentialism, postmodernism, and now neo-paganism. So I do like that he looks at it not just from the perspective of philosophical worldviews, but he also looks at it from the perspective of history, and the reason why that's important, because history, you can learn a lot from history. It's often been said that he who doesn't study history is doomed to repeat the mistakes from the past. And but whatever the case, when you watch the changes, I mean, I am still shocked at the rapid succession of changes that are going on in our culture. I'm shocked at how quickly it's happening, but it all makes sense to me. because of my research into worldviews. And ideas have consequences. And a worldview is that's the foundation for your ideas. So worldviews have consequences. And but I think that we can get all caught up chasing the wrong thing and not the real substance. It's like that night we were looking for that guy roaming around. Half the time I'd see a shadow and I'd go after the shadow and you know, we need to be careful. And I think that Americans, with 9/11, American Christians, all of a sudden we got our focus off the push towards neo-pagan globalism, and we acted like Islam was the number one enemy. And then we Christians started arguing for very strict laws against the Muslims, which if we didn't even see, those same strict laws could be used against us. Now, I think if you really look at it in proper perspective, Islam is important and needs to be combated, but it's being funded by powerful Westerners who want a new world order. And so I really think when you look at, you kind of, when you see us going from Christian theism to the West, that is, to deism, to naturalism or atheism, to postmodernism, this denial of absolute truth and all, and then we start creating our own absolutes and stuff, it seems to me that neo-pagan globalism, kind of a global religion of the new tolerance, is a much more likely place, destination for us. And if we're not careful, be totally honest with you, I don't think America's got anything to worry about terrorism. You just encourage our right to bear arms and protect our borders. And don't even allow legal immigration unless the people are vetted properly. We'll do just fine. You know, if you encourage the right to bear arms, if the Japanese didn't want to invade us during World War II, what are a bunch of Muslim terrorists going to do? You know, I mean, you start having a few glitches like that in Texas when they were drawing Muhammad, and the guy starts shooting and he gets shot. The terrorists get shot. So you have enough episodes like that, and I think we'll do just fine. But I think when you look at the history of Western thought, you start to see that all of a sudden it's the lie in the garden that man is God. And now, by the way, as we combat Islam and as we debate Jews, it is nice to know, and then even libertarian atheists, it is nice to know that those might be people we get to witness to in the last days, because they are the least likely people to genuflect before an all-powerful state that says, you know, that attacks their own beliefs. And so in other words, you know, if Christians go through the tribulation, I hope I'm wrong on that, but I do think we're going to. But if we go through the tribulation, there's going to be other people besides Christians who refuse to bow before the Antichrist. So it gives us at least it gives us somebody to witness to as we're fleeing through the woods and trying to get out of town. Now, I hope I'm wrong. I hope we do get raptured out, but I don't like pain. My doctor warned me against it. So let's take a look at Christian theism. And it's really weird, too, because with Christianity, don't forget, too, we often think of Christianity as coming on the scene so late. You know, even if we take a young earth position and say that creation was 6,000 BC, which I, by the way, am a young earther, why would a true religion take 4,000 BC. I actually made myself. Okay, so 4,000 BC. So why would it take 4,000 years for the true religion to come into existence? That doesn't seem to make sense. Okay? But what we've got to realize is that Christianity's fulfillment of Judaism, which kind of got its start with Abraham at 2,000 BC. And, you know, you got Moses in 1500 BC. And that's around the same time. Moses is about the same time as Hinduism. You got about 600 BC. You got Buddhism. Okay? So, right there, just by tying us into the Jewish faith, it pushes it back. But we got to also understand that the true faith was first proclaimed right after man fell in the garden. And God promised that a man would be born of woman who would defeat Satan, crush the head of the serpent, but would be bruised, would suffer in the process. So it's the first prediction. By the way, it's the only time in scriptures the seed of the woman is mentioned. Because the seed is technically what the man contributes to the birth of a child. Okay? We usually translate it offspring, but it really means a seed. The seed is really the sperm. So it's almost implied that there's going to be a man born a woman without the ancient agency of another man. So it's almost implied a virgin birth. And that the Savior, so the idea of the suffering Savior, Melchizedek taught this, the godly line taught this before the flood and all. And so basically, the one true faith goes all the way back to the garden in Genesis 3:15 when God promised to rescue mankind. But when it comes to Christianity, until about approximately 320 AD, when Constantine converted to Christianity, the church was persecuted by Rome. Okay? And then by about 380 AD, all of a sudden, Christianity was the dominant worldview until probably the 1600s. We'll talk about what went on there. But I actually think the healthiest days of the church were the days of persecution. Even saints, even saved humans, we don't handle power too well. And so once we got political power, we started blending biblical Christianity with Roman paganism. That's what I think the product of that was, Roman Catholicism. And it's one of the reasons why I'm not Roman Catholic. But Tertullian said the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The fact that Christians are willing to die for the faith, that's what caused Christianity to grow. But when all of a sudden we're the ones in power, and then we start putting down other people, it kind of takes from the gospel. And by the way, I think we've had it more difficult than a lot of Christian saints who live in other parts of the world. They're being persecuted. And the early church that's being persecuted, there is a sense where we have it more difficult than them. Because their only choice, I mean, it's just like, okay, if I don't want to conform to the pattern of the world, and I want to be transformed by the renewing of my mind, all that means is just being Christian. You just study the Word, be filled with the Holy Spirit. I mean, you have no political say. So you don't even bother getting, I mean, was he leading a Operation Rescue for the babies in the Roman Empire that are being discarded? No, he's preaching the gospel. I mean, it was just like, now early church started getting into that, and that's a good thing. But what I'm saying is the more political power we have, the more complicated the answer is to the question, how shall we then live? So we have to decide, okay, how can I be a good Christian? And part of being a good Christian is being a good citizen. And I have all this political power and political say. I got to vote wisely. I got to study the candidates. We had a lady at the talk I gave last night, and she was mentioning, yeah, we need more church involvement in, you know, RU753 and BT491. You know, she's just reeling off the nuts. I had no idea what she was talking about other than she was telling me legislation that I'm uninformed about. You know? And I have to admit, part of me just kind of, I'm more of a worldview guy more than a political analyst. And I just can't keep up with all this stuff. And we do need Christians who do. But it's really tough when you have to say, how can I be a good Christian and a good citizen? When you have all this political say, there's so much responsibility that's there. When we lose all that political power, then it's just going to be, okay, how do we just be a good Christian, and is there any way we can get away with it without getting thrown in prison and being beat up on? So, great, I'm not looking forward to persecution, but, you know, it's not going to be, you know, you're not going to have Christian brothers walking up to you and say, why did you vote for Trump? He's got a foul mouth. He calls people names and stuff like that. It's like, well, when we don't really have the right to vote at all, we won't even have to worry about all those political, you know. And by the way, that's, people act like because the Bible regulated slavery and tried to humanize it, that the Bible was pro-slavery. The fact of the matter was, though, ancient slavery was economic. And then contemporary slavery was a thing started by the Muslims and the kidnapping of others in the slave trade. But the fact of the matter is, Christianity cannot solve political problems if your Christians don't have political say. And now just think about how few Americans, with a small percentage, really are Christians. Yet we still have a lot of say. You realize that with Nigeria, about half the population is Christian. But the other half is militant Muslims. So Boko Haram is just, you know, anytime they feel like it, they'll go to a Christian girls' school and kidnap 200 teenage girls to be sex slaves or their wives or whatever. And in fact, I think there was one Nigerian bishop who allowed his people to start fighting back. He got tired of seeing too many church buildings burnt down, too many charred bodies. And he said, you know what, you can start fighting back. And I thought, finally, CNN's going to report on it now. Once the Christians fight back, then I'll be like, oh, once again, religious war broke out between the militant Christians and the Muslim guys, you know. And, but whatever the case, so we're seeing Christianity grow in leaps and bounds, but it's where they don't have political say. So there's a big shift going on, and it's all worldview related. But just keep in mind, though, when we're talking about the Christian worldview, getting that political say, okay, from about, we'll carry this down to 2018, okay, this is where all of a sudden, you know, we have a big amount of say. But now I would be arguing since the 1960s, we have not been the primary voice in America. Now you go to Europe, and you can go 100 years before that, 150 years before that, where we didn't have, weren't the primary voice. But I do think we are going to need to reread the book of Acts closer, because that's the kind of world we're going to be looking at. So what Sire does, he goes to, looks at it from a historical perspective, and he shows that, in fact, he starts out in chapter 2 on page 25, in the Western world, That's Europe and America. In the Western world, up to the end of the 17th century, so that's the late 1600s, the theistic worldview, and it would be Christian theism, was clearly dominant. Okay? And so he said that there was intramural squabbles between different kinds of Catholics, different kinds of Protestants, okay? But it was taken for granted that the triune personal God of the scriptures actually did exist. And so if you go to page 28, he talks about worldview question number one. It says, prime reality is the infinite personal God revealed in the Holy Scriptures. This God is triune, transcendent and immanent, omniscient, sovereign, and good. Okay? So there's a lot for us to unpack there before we even get to the second worldview question. So when it deals with the prime reality, Christian theism is going to say the prime reality, the ultimate reality, is the infinite personal triune God revealed in scriptures. So God is infinite, he is personal, transcendent, immanent. So we'll look at a few of these attributes of God. Okay, infinite, what does infinite mean?
He had no beginning and he has no end.
Okay, that's infinite in the term of time and eternity. So by being infinite, he has to be eternal. Because if he's infinite, what is he not? If he's infinite, he's not limited. He's not finite. He's not limited by anything. So he's not limited by time, so he's eternal. Okay? Now, he's not limited by matter. The thing is, Aquinas would argue if finite being exists, limited being exists, then infinite being has to exist to ground our continuing existence. But once you acknowledge that infinite being exists, a lot of things come into play. Like, for instance, infinite being must be eternal, but infinite being must also be one. There cannot be two infinite beings or more. Because if there are two infinite beings, they would limit each other, and then they wouldn't be infinite. Okay? Another way of looking at it, an infinite being has to have every possible perfection, and has to have every possible perfection to an infinite degree. But for two beings to differ, one being has to have some perfection that the other being lacks, or vice versa. Or maybe they have all the perfections, but one has them to a greater degree than the other. Well, if it's infinite being has to have every possible perfection and has to have every possible perfection to an infinite degree. By definition, there can't be two of them. And with the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, you cannot differentiate between them in the realm of being. The realm of being is what God has to be God. Okay? Now, you're a human being. Okay? Human beings generally, you know, they have one head, two arms, and two legs. Does that mean if you lose an arm, you cease to be human? No. So that's not essential to being human. But your nature, being a human being, you have to have certain things. I probably couldn't even spell out all the things you'd have to have. And I'd probably throw in a few things that you really don't have to have. But really, when you strip it down, what do you have to be a human being? And that's like when I debated Chris Date on, he didn't believe that hell is forever. He believed that, he believes like Jehovah's Witnesses that we cease to exist between physical death and the resurrection, and then the non-saved just get, the wicked get annihilated, even though Jesus referred to hell as a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. The worm does not die. The fires are not quenched. They have no rest in the book of Revelation, no rest day or night forever and ever. But where I really nailed this guy on was with Jesus. If Jesus was fully human, if there's no such thing as a human between physical death and resurrection, then the time that Jesus spent in the tomb, was he human at all? And it really caused a lot of problems in his thought. So even having a physical body is not essential to being human. Now, I do think in the glorified state, you know, we're going to have that resurrection body. But the fact of the matter is, in between physical death and physical resurrection, bodily resurrection, you're still a human being. You're a human being in an abnormal state, but you're still a human being. And but God, as God, has to have every possible perfection and to an infinite degree. So God, if he's infinite, has to be eternal, has to be one. He has to be almighty. He's going to be all-powerful. He cannot be limited by anything outside of his own nature. Okay? And there's a lot of guys still using outdated arguments against Christianity where they say that if God is all-powerful, he's almighty, if he's all-powerful, then also known as omnipotent, God is all-powerful, he can do anything, including create a rock that's so big that even he can't lift it. But then if he can't lift the rock, he's not all-powerful. Okay? Now, the problem with that is no thinking Christian theologian or philosopher for the past 2,000 years ever defined God being all-powerful as the ability to do anything. Okay? Even when Jesus says all things are possible with God, it basically means all things that God sets out to do are possible for him. But the Bible teaches there's some things it's impossible for God to do. It's impossible for God to sin. It's impossible for God to lie. It's impossible for God to change his mind. If God's all powerful, it's impossible for him to fail. And creating a rock too big for him to lift, that would be a failure. So they're saying if God can do anything, he can even fail. But then if he could fail, he's not all powerful. It's like, what are you talking about, dude? But all powerful means that God's not limited by anything outside his own good, rational nature. Okay? So God, even God cannot create square circles. By definition, those are impossible things. Okay? God cannot create a God that's greater than him. It's impossible. And but God being almighty means he's infinite, he's not limited by anything other than his own good nature. God is omnipresent. He's everywhere present at once because he's not limited by space. All this just flows from being infinite. He's omniscient. He's all-knowing. Because he's not limited by ignorance. Okay? Now, imminence, and transcendence are very important to the theistic concept of God. Because the deists would say God is transcendent. God is totally other. He is separate from the universe he created. But the deists would say that God just created the universe like a clock and wound it up and left it on his own. The theists would say, no, God has to sustain us in existence, that which he created. But also that God can intervene and supersede the laws of nature and perform miracles. So God is separate from and far away, that's transcendence, but he's close to or near us, that's immanence. It's like Psalm 145, 18 and 19, King David says, the Lord is near to all who call on him. To all who call on him in truth, he'll hear their desire and save them. But the Lord is near. That's imminence. To all who call on him, to all who call on him in truth. So there's imminence where this faraway God, this transcendent God, is near to us if we call out to him. Okay? And so in theism, you get both of those. Now, he doesn't, there's a few, a few attributes that he kind of leaves out. And of course, nobody can get them all, basically. But he is personal. So God is personal. In fact, if it's Christianity, Christian theism, God is tri-personal. But it's like God is not some non-personal force like electricity. It's not the force be with you. It's the Lord be with you. And so God is a personal God who can love us and give us moral commands. God is sovereign. He's always in control. God is good. You could add to this list, God is loving. He's merciful, doesn't give us the punishment we deserve. He's gracious. He gives us the salvation we don't deserve. Okay? But God is good. He is just. He's righteous. He is fair. One attribute too deals with God's transcendence. God is holy. And we often think holiness means absolute purity. Well, that's what holiness leads to, but holiness just means totally distinct, totally separate. So when the Ten Commandments say, thou shalt not take God's name in vain, and we think, okay, as long as I don't say God's name with a curse word, I haven't taken it in vain. But when you look at the Our Father, Jesus gave us the pattern for prayer. He said, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, holy be thy name. What he's saying is, your name is so totally different from everything else that exists. So every time we talk about God as if God is just one of the finite things that exist, and we treat God like he's just a finite created thing, that's taking God's name in vain. So the Jews understood, man, it's like, man, if that's the case, I'm not even going to say his name. I'm not even going to write his name. To this day, Orthodox rabbis will write G-G-d. And, yeah, in fact, it's called the Nomina Sacra, the early ancient Christian manuscripts. They would, instead of theos, word for God, okay, they have, they wouldn't even want to write out God. You know what's interesting too? The Kurios, they do that for Kurios too in the ancient manuscripts. But Jesus is called Kurios, Lord, over and over again in the New Testament. The Greek word Kurios, the early church understood that they were calling Jesus Yahweh, okay? And, Jesus, okay? Aye, this is an E. Aye makes the Y sound. Jesus, for Jesus. I'm not even sure if I got the spelling right there. It's been so long. But they did that. The early church and their copies. Nomina sacra, sacred name. What does that tell you? What are they treating Jesus' name like?
Deity.
Was that?
Deity.
Deity, yeah. They're saying, when we mention Jesus, we mention the divine name. My father had a little bit of that to him. Growing up as a kid, every time he said the word Jesus or he heard somebody else say, he bowed his head. And so I think he understood what it meant to take God's name in vain and didn't want to do it. See, with transcendence, God being this, you know, and God is separated from us in that he's the infinite creator, everything else is finite. He's totally pure. We're sinful. So you end up, holiness does end up with like absolute purity. But that's kind of the result of being holy, not the cause of being holy. But it's kind of like, I had a friend who said this, I don't know what preacher he stole it from, but he said that Jesus does not want to be a part of your life. Okay? The Mariners can be part of your life, the Seahawks can be part of your life. If you're really brilliant, the Raiders can be part of your life. That's okay. But Jesus doesn't want to be part of your life, he wants to be your life. So the Raiders are like a backpack that you can wear when you want, take it off when you want. If the Seahawks lose their first four games, there'll probably be some Seahawks fans that are so spoiled with winning seasons that they'll probably take the backpacks off and maybe they'll start rooting for the Rams or the 49ers or something. You know? But Jesus doesn't want to be part of your life, he wants to be your life. And when we take God's name in vain, we don't acknowledge God's holiness, and we act like he's just a part of things that exist. We act like he's not the ultimate reality, that he's not the way, the truth, and the life. Okay? And so these are just some of the attributes of God, but he's just, he's not limited by injustice. Loving, he seeks the greatest good of his creation without expecting anything in return. So, but whatever the case, this is all tied in to that first thing for the Christian worldview. The first worldview question for God being infinite.